Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with my colleagues Parul Segal and Jennifer Salai about some important new books dealing with women's issues.
These women are sort of remaking the workplace so that it is not only welcoming women's ambition, but also reorganizing things so that women can, for instance, try to balance work and family.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Tom Rees takes us inside the complex world of the actual Count of Monte Cristo.
In some ways, he's like Barack Obama and Colin Powell with a little bit of Joe Lewis, but in the 18th century, at the height of slavery.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This week, we have a special issue. It's called A Woman's Place, and it examines from various perspectives the condition of women in our society, also some of the issues that important women writers and critics are talking about, particularly in this election year. I'm joined by two of my great colleagues, Jennifer Salai and Parul Segal, who are much involved in this issue and are going to illuminate us all. Jen Salai, one of our featured books is called The End of Men. It's by Hannah Rosen, much esteemed journalist. Tell us a little bit about sort of the backstory of this book. It began as a quite provocative magazine article. Is that right?
Yes, it began as a magazine article for The Atlantic, where Hannah Rosen is an editor. She basically cites a statistic that has been cited over and over again the past few years since the recession began, saying that most of the jobs lost, I believe it's about three quarters of the jobs lost during this recession, were men's jobs.
That is quite a jarring statistic.
Indeed.
So what kinds of jobs are we talking about? Are there men's jobs versus women's jobs? It seemed that we'd kind of move beyond that culturally, but maybe not.
Well, I mean, the decline of manufacturing, that's a big one. So, I mean, you know, just looking at the past few years, what's happened to the auto industry and just generally what's happened to manufacturing has really been quite devastating to men. So that's one of the things she looks at.
And what kind of jobs have replaced those that women seem to be flourishing in?
One of the things that she points to, one of the growing industries, is healthcare. Education. So some of the caring professions like nurses, there's always a high demand for that, and that's only been increasing because of the aging population.
Now, Parul Segal, let me ask you what might seem a provocative question. For somebody of my generation, we won't even get into my age. Healthcare, education, those seem kind of like traditional women's jobs. So are we looking at an economy that's sort of moved in the direction of women, or are we looking really at the ascendancy of women in other areas too?
That's a point that Rosen tackles, that not only are these jobs service industry jobs, and as Jen pointed out, caring professions, they also seem to privilege what are stereotypically feminine traits. The ability to sit still, the ability to be solicitous, the ability to listen, be less assertive almost, seem to be in demand and seem to be helping girls.
This isn't news, and either or both of you. Girls, we kind of think, I'm father of a daughter, seem to do a little better in school. We know that on elite college campuses, sometimes the disparity between men and women students can be quite surprising. You know, as many as 60% of the undergraduates at strong academic institutions will be women. Does this mean that going forward, we're seeing more better educated women than men? Is this a kind of crisis in the culture, Jen Salai?
Well, I mean, I think what Rosen does point out is that you're absolutely right. That 60% figure is that's the figure of degrees, undergraduate degrees that are going to women. And so you have this cohort of women who are very well educated. But at the same time, the question becomes, at a time of economic change, what are they educated for? And I think that this is one of the things that Rosen tries to grapple with in the book. And she does have a chapter on women at the top. So you have this these very well-educated women at, say, Google and Facebook, who are reaching positions of extraordinary power.
Who are becoming famous,
exactly,
some of them.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And what that portends, I guess, for the younger women who are coming up through this educational system. Because really that's part of the hope, I guess, that Rosen is suggesting, that these women are sort of remaking the workplace so that it is not only welcoming women's ambition, but also reorganizing things so that women can, for instance, try to balance work and family, which is really one of the more elusive goals of the feminist movement.
Well, in fact, Parle, there was a quite controversial essay written also in the Atlantic mm-hmm. Monthly by Anne-Marie Slaughter, who was a ranking official in Obama's State Department, who kind of challenged this notion that women can have it all, that you can have the big high-powered job and also take the kid to soccer practice or be there to make dinner at night. Are there new pressures being exerted on these high-achieving women, Parle?
I think so. And I think that one of the points Rosen makes in her book is that as women become, as generally saying, more powerful within these institutions, they can sort of reshape roles women take on. They can sort of reshape work schedules, they can make jobs more family friendly.
Okay, now we're looking exclusively, or so far, at the United States. Is there a global aspect to this argument or this set of questions as well, Jen?
Yeah, she has an entire chapter actually on women in Asia, and she is looking at the rise of some women within the workforce ranks in Asia. But at the same time, the culture there, she points out, is very resistant to allowing women, for example, to sort of give some of their housework or their chores to the men in their lives. I mean, actually, the same issue she does point out is also present in the U.S., where women now have a double duty or a second shift. After they come home from their high-powered jobs, they're still the ones who spend more time on childcare than their husbands. But really, the focus is mostly on the United States.
We have another book that's got a tremendous amount of attention. It's called Vagina, a new biography. It's by Naomi Wolf, who's quite a well-known writer, feminist, provocateur. Parle, what's she doing in this book? Do we know?
That's the question on everybody's mind. So Naomi Wolf was 46 and freshly in love. And suddenly she just started feeling just inexplicably morose. She describes it like the color just drained out of the world. And she was having like what she thought was a pretty decent sex life with her partner at the time. She goes to the doctor and discovers that she has a compressed pelvic nerve that prevents her from having the sorts of deep vaginal orgasms she was accustomed to. So she gets it fixed, has this sort of epiphany that she is, or that women are, essentially the importance of this nerve, the importance of a certain kind of sexuality to women is integral, she thinks, to women's creativity, to women's productivity, and to women's happiness.
But so, this is a hugely ambitious book, right?
It's called A New Biography. So she's trying to tell the story, and what she thinks is a pretty hidden, suppressed story of the vagina and how it relates to the brain and how it relates to women's sense of well-being.
So she's drawing on, what, neuroscience, some of the newer areas of investigation. Is that right, Jen?
Yes.
Is there some of that?
Yes.
And why has the reaction, and let's be honest, including in our own pages, been so intense, let's say? The New York Review of Books, very distinguished publication. The New Yorker had a long essay about this book. We have kind of, you know, a long and, what shall we say, flamboyant one by our reviewer, Tony Bentley. Katie Royfe has written about it in Slate. It's women who are writing about this book. Briefly, what are some of the issues they're raising, either one of you?
Well, I mean, I think one of the main issues that is being raised is, you know, by writing a book about the vagina, that's called Vagina, that focuses entirely on the vagina, you're really sort of bringing up an issue that's come up again and again among women in feminism, which is the role of the body and whether or not a woman's biology dictates anything else in their lives. And so I think that that's been one of the flashpoints in the book, which is really if as Wolf suggests the vagina is so important, not only in terms of a woman's biology, but also in terms of her well-being, the way she looks at the world. What does that say about the differences between men and women? Does that portend something potentially troubling in terms of feminism and the women's movement? And I think that that's what some reviewers have taken issue with.
And at the same time, we're now looking at a presidential election that, to the surprise of many, including myself, has a much stronger component of debates about social issues, including reproductive rights, choice for women. Some of it even had to do with varieties of sex. Mm-hmm. Are these issues now, which are in many ways being directed by women, the discussion and debate by women, are they entering more the mainstream conversation than they did, say, even 10 years ago?
I'd like to think so. I'd like to think that we're always moving to points of greater transparency and conversation about this. And I think that just following up on what Jen was saying, is a little bit about or influences some of the reactions that this book is getting, is that people think that there really is a time for an honest discussion about 5,000 years of maligned, just disrespected female sexuality. And there's another review in this issue, a book called Breasts by Florence Williams.
Very serious.
A very serious book. And I think people were hoping that this book would be a little bit more like Breasts.
That Wolf's would be.
Yes, that would talk more about the vagina.
Is hers really almost scientific?
I think it's much more scientific. I mean, Naomi Wolf is getting a lot of criticism for sort of being a little too free with the science, but Williams's book is very, very rigorous, and she talks about both the breast and like popular culture and as different things that are going on in the research and stuff like that. But it's not personal, whereas Wolf's story is essentially like a very deeply personal story. This happened to me. I am this. And she generalizes it and sort of says that all women are affected by their vaginas in the way that I am. And, this is also the same woman who, with the beauty myth, made her name by saying that as women become more and more powerful, we are reminded by the media that we are our bodies. We are held to even more fascistic sort of standards of beauty. So I think people feel some betrayal.
Okay. Now let's look at another major figure in American cultural intellectual history. There's a new biography of the great Rachel Carson. It's called On a Farther Shore, The Life and Legacy of Rachel Carson. And most of our listeners will know that it was Carson who awakened America just about half a century ago to the dangers of pesticides and really brought environmentalism into the consciousness of so many citizens. In some way, was it almost, not going to say Rachel Carson had it easy. I mean, she was an extraordinary figure. She's a pioneer. But in that period, could an intellectual and thinker and journalist like her, who was a woman, just write about big issues that didn't have anything to do with sex and gender and the war between men and women in a way that it's harder for women to do now? Jen?
I don't know if this is a question, actually. It's something that I've actually been thinking about. If it's a question of gender so much as it is just sort of a cultural change that's affected the cultural authority of not only women but also men, where it's...
What do you mean?
Well, just to sort of make a book that really changes the culture, changes the way that we see things. I mean, I think it's just much harder to do now in a more fragmented environment. And so I'm not so sure if it's a question of, is it harder for women now to do that as it is just, is it hard for people in general? I mean, it is true that right now, as you point out on the cover of the book review, we have two books by women about specifically women's issues, and they're big books. But at the same time, comparing it with the kind of authority that Rachel Carson had, I'm not sure if it's so much a difference that, now women can write about their own experience and their own bodies and have authority, whereas before they could write about anything and have authority, or just in general, it's just harder to speak with authority on some of these things.
Well, Pearl, a book that's almost exactly contemporary to Rachel Carson's great Silent Spring was A Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan.
Yeah.
Came out just about a year later, I think. And it also, it awakened a generation of women to some of the limitations in their existence. It was also a huge comment on society itself. Yeah. And do we think that all of these discussions and debates, the issues that we are being dealt with now, and they should be dealt with now, that's what's on people's minds, may open the way toward broader discussions that reach into new areas? What do you think, Barbara?
I hope so. I mean, I don't think Vagina is the book to do it, because I think Vagina brings up debates that a lot of women feel were finished, clitoral versus vaginal orgasms. Really?
You know, kind of settled a long time ago.
Yeah, and I think that... I think that The End of Men and the Anne Marie Slaughter book are moving us into more interesting ground where women and work are being debated. And I really hope to see a silent spring on the topic of women and work.
Thanks so much, Parul Sehgal and Jennifer Salai. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So from the op-ed page to a published book, what's going on here?
It seems like it was only a few months ago, but Greg Smith, the derivatives salesman at Goldman Sachs, who wrote an op-ed for The Times called Why I Left Goldman Sachs, that was essentially an explosion throughout the bank and Wall Street, is now out with the book that it was based on that op-ed, and it's coming out next month.
Julie, in the op-ed, Greg Smith, if I remember, kind of confessed to what many people had suspected anyway, that a lot of the wheelings and dealings in the finance industry had become compromised in some ways. And is that what this book does? Does it provide more detail? Do we know what's in the book?
We haven't seen the book yet. But we know that his opinion article in The Times talked about his disappointment with the toxic, destructive culture at Goldman. He wrote about how his former colleagues had mocked their clients. They referred to them as Muppets. He talked about how there was a decline in the firm's moral fiber that, as he said, represents the single most serious threat to Goldman's long-term survival.
And Julie, when he wrote that, it was a kind of public resignation letter, right? Didn't he quit right around that time or the next day?
It was. I think he quit that morning, if I can remember. I mean, if you want to resign in spectacular fashion, the op-ed page of the New York Times is usually a great way to do it.
Book review editor says his eyes are tired. Read it on the op-ed page. He's leaving now.
So we know that Greg Smith has spent his time since then working on this book. It only took a few days for Grand Central, part of Hachette, to
snap it up,
to get that book deal. I think it came down to Grand Central and also Penguin. And they paid $1.5 million in an advance.
Wow, that's probably almost a fraction of one of his Christmas bonuses. This was not a guy who was making a ton of money.
He was not a guy who made a ton of money. I think that he made something like $500,000 a year, which is a lot in journalism money, but not that much in Wall Street money. I think that he, you know, wanted this book to come out quickly, and the publishers who met him also wanted it to come out quickly because, of course, this is a test for a current affairs book. Do people remember Greg Smith? You know, now that we're talking about it, of course, you know, we remember the details. But I think that
though the name Greg Smith is, we don't necessarily have it foremost in our
minds. It's a problem. Yeah. But I think that, you know, it was such a splashy story when it came out. And this will be a book that's of great interest, certainly on Wall Street and probably beyond.
Now, we don't know what's in it. We haven't seen it. Do we know if he had a co-author or ghostwriter?
We know that he wrote the first draft himself. That was something that he was very insistent on, I'm told. He wanted to write the book himself, but he did get some assistance from a professional writer who, you know, provided advice and helped him polish the manuscript. And the book's editor is John Brody, who was a former editor at Fortune magazine, so who's very familiar.
So he knows his way around this kind of material.
Absolutely. Because
isn't that part of the difficulty too, Julie, when we think of a really successful writer about finance like Michael Lewis. I mean, part of the genius of what he's able to do is to explain it, to take you inside that world. For Greg Smith's book, I mean, you've looked at and written about many a bestseller in your time. What does that book have to do to become the kind of success its publisher is hoping for?
I think it really has to be accessible in the way that, you know, Michael Lewis has perfected. When I read The Big Short, Michael Lewis's great book, I believe it came out after 2008. I think it came out in 2010, actually. You know, that book really told you a lot about finance, but it did it in a completely accessible way. You know, I may not have been able to explain to you what a CDO was by the end of the book, but I felt that I understood it when I was reading the book, which is an incredibly difficult thing to do.
But Julie, isn't that also in part because Lewis tells stories about people?
Yes.
And do we have a sense of whether Greg Smith will do this? Will he tell his story, story of the people he worked with and the decisions they made?
We know that the book will talk about Smith's personal journey through Goldman. So I think that what this book will rise or fall on is how compelling that personal journey is. We know that he was someone who was a mid-level employee. Did he have access to the secrets that the firm kept? Is he going to offer us details about Goldman that we didn't already know?
Because you'll remember, and listeners may too, the op-ed piece did not have a great deal of detail in it.
Very few details. And I think that was one thing that publishers were a little bit concerned about when they talked to him about this book. Does he have the goods? And so I think that that is certainly one of the big questions about this book. You know, does he really have a great story to tell? However, there really haven't been tell-all books about Goldman Sachs. So it may be that the insights and revelations that he has ready to go in this book might be new enough to really be compelling.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Listeners and readers will remember Tom Rees's previous book, The Orientalist, a critically acclaimed and international bestseller. Now, 7 years later, he's got a new book. It's called The Black Count, Glory, Revolution, Betrayal, and The Real Count of Monte Cristo. It's reviewed for us by a very distinguished scholar, Leo Damrosch, who says that Rees has recovered a fascinating story with a richly imaginative biography. I'm delighted that Tom Rees is here to talk about his book. Welcome.
Hi, Sam. Nice to be here.
Okay, Tom, tell us, first of all, who was the Black Count?
The Black Count of my title was General Alex Dumas, the father of the famous novelist Alexandre Dumas, author of The Three Musketeers, The Count of Monte Cristo. But General Alex Dumas was one of history's most odds-defying characters. He rose from being a black slave, son of a slave, and a renegade aristocrat from the French colony of Saint-Domingue, to becoming one of the top generals and a rival of Napoleon, a guy who led, a black man who led 50,000 white troops in the conquest of the Alps for France, before getting thrown in a dungeon and having his career kind of unraveled and buried by Napoleon. So in a lot of ways, Alex Dumas could be considered sort of the patron saint of modern special forces. On the other hand, he was the black leader who rose highest in a white society before our own time, really before anybody. In some ways, he's like Barack Obama and Colin Powell with a little bit of Joe Lewis, but in the 18th century at the height of slavery. So he's this black man who rises to the very top of white society.
How did he do it? How could that happen?
Well, it's an amazing story that brought me into the history of a really amazing and forgotten time when there was a kind of post-racial opening in the 18th century.
And when in the 18th century are we talking about?
Basically, Alex Dumas was born in 1762 in Saint-Domingue, And he makes it to France in 1776, the year our revolution breaks out. And he arrives in France listed in the ship's manifest as the slave Alexander. A year later, he's gotten himself into the Royal Fencing Academy and in short order becomes the second greatest swordsman in France. And kind of the amazing side of his sort of fencing training is that he's being trained by the greatest swordsman in France and all of Europe, in fact, who is another mixed race man, who's in fact a black man with a somewhat similar background. And so these two black men in Paris, both sons of slaves, on the eve of the French Revolution, they are the greatest sword fighters in France. And when the revolution breaks out, among many other adventures, they form something called the Black Legion to fight for really extending liberty, equality, fraternity to people of all races and colors.
So they're soldiers on the side of the revolution, right? He's in his mid to late 20s now.
Exactly. In his mid-20s, he becomes a red, white, and blue soldier of the revolution, a kind of super French patriot. He sees the revolution, Alex Dumas sees the revolution as the one chance for people of color to sort of partake in the gifts of liberty. Because what I found out was that all of the French revolutionaries are looking over their shoulder tremendously at the American Revolution, which many of them have been involved in. Alex Dumas, at this point, amazingly, the son of a slave, is traveling in a milieu with Lafayette and people like that. And in fact, they all see the American Revolution as this tragic, unfinished business because they're very, very aware, even in the end of the 18th century, that slavery was not addressed and that black, you know, there's this great hypocrisy.
Or addressed but set aside. I mean, there were battles yes. about it, and it was decided that that's for another day.
Exactly. And what I've discovered in the course of this story, there is this forgotten civil rights movement that happened in France in the 18th century that was really at the heart of the Enlightenment. It was not a sideshow, and it involved all of these leading thinkers in Paris essentially taking on the French Empire, because at this point, the French Empire was the greatest slave empire in the world.
It's and
the
tell reason- us where some of the holdings were. Oh. Some of them are right here in our neck of the woods.
Well, absolutely. The French Empire was based in what is now what became Haiti, which was their greatest colony, Saint-Domingue, which was the sort of Saudi Arabia of the 18th century. Only in the 18th century, it wasn't oil, it was sugar. Sugar was the most valuable commodity in the world.
And these are like massive plantations.
Massive slave plantations where really the conditions were far harsher than anything that ever existed in the Cotton Kingdom in the United States. And this was really the money upon which Versailles and all the glory of France was built. It was all built on the backs of the harshest slave empire in the world. But for kind of complicated legal and philosophical reasons, the French Empire was the only slave empire, unlike the Spanish or the British slave empires, where a kind of legal battle, fierce legal battle, opened up in the middle of the 18th century to defend the rights of blacks and, in fact, to break down aspects of slavery. And it gave this sort of bizarre condition. It created this bizarre condition where the French had, on the one hand, they had the harshest slave empire in the world. On the other hand, there was a mixed race population in their main colony that was putting on operas and staging big balls. And there were a few blacks and men of color who made it to France. And when they made it to France, because of the civil rights battles that were going on there, they achieved a kind of gray status where, in fact, in the case of Alex Dumas, he was allowed to inherit a noble title and be a count. While at the same time, there were these race laws that said he was in jeopardy of being deported back to the colony in slavery. And this was all under the king in the 1770s and 1780s. So when the revolution broke out, Alex Dumas saw this as this sort of incredible opportunity for total freedom
right,
for blacks.
Right, to grasp the ring of freedom for everyone.
This was really a post-racial idea of freedom that was embraced by Alex Dumas and his fellow black swordsmen in the Black Legion, but it was also embraced by a huge number of white French revolutionaries, so that there was this idea of creating a mixed-race society. The head of the French Senate in the 1790s was a black man. Mm-hmm. And they actually created integrated schools in Paris. But the most amazing thing to me about all of this is Alex Dumas' personal life. Dumas rides in to a little town in the height of the revolution in 1789 to kind of protect it from rioting and brigands. And there, a white French girl named Marie-Louise sees this great black swordsman, and she falls over head over heels in love with him. He falls in love with her, and Alex Dumas proposes to her father, and this white Frenchman who's never seen a black man before has no problem with his race at all. The only problem he has is that Alex Dumas is still a private.
You mean he hasn't risen high enough up in the army, in the ranks?
Yeah, because Alex Dumas actually just joined the French army at the lowest rank as a private. And he's still a private, and he says, come back and propose to my daughter when you've at least got your sergeant stripes. And of course, Dumas comes back, and he's got a lot more than his sergeant stripes because he is such a super soldier that within 2 years, he's risen to the rank of general. He's appointed at the height of the French terror, which is a whole other story. He's given this command. He's actually given a command of 50,000 troops on a glacier in the Alps at a time when Robespierre and the Committee of Public Safety are taking the revolution to this awful, bloody place.
No, it's a bloodbath at
this point. It's a bloodbath, and Alex Dumas is very much, on the one hand, the Jacobins were the people who pushed the final button on full emancipation and also full post-racial society. And on the other hand, Dumas then spends all of his time sparring with the Jacobins and nearly gets his head cut off. So
now, Tom, as we discuss this very rich and complex tapestry of a life and a culture and a time, you're referring more than once to materials you found. Where is all this material? What were some of the really good finds you made, and where were they?
Obviously, a lot of, the great, great material on the blow-by-blow of all of the battles I just found in the French military archives at the Chateau de Vincennes in Paris, which are incredible archives that save everything. And Alex Dumas, even though he's forgotten today, was such a Audie Murphy character during this time that there are a million descriptions of his great
feats. So all
of
his exploits are being written about.
Written
by hand, much of this?
Oh,
or
by hand. This is incredible. This is why it took 7 years, really, is that the only document no one's really written ever about Alex Dumas before, except, interestingly, his son, the novelist, which we could get to. But I'm going through all this stuff really for the first time, and it's all in this wonderful, flowery 18th century handwriting. So thousands of pages that I had to make my way through. But all of this is the military side. And to get the personal side of the story, which is what I really wanted, and also to find the thing that made him the inspiration for the Count of Monte Cristo, which is part of my fascination with him, because I knew this was the case. I did what struck me as the obvious thing. I went to the town where General Alex Dumas died in 1806.
What town is that?
It's a little town to the northeast of Paris called Villers-Cotterêts. Well, first of all, I went there because I'd gotten into a correspondence with a woman who'd been hoarding some documents.
Pertaining to him and his career.
Pertaining to the Dumas family. Mm. And I went looking for this lady, and I had the bad luck that the lady had actually dropped dead 2 weeks before I got there. And she had put all of these documents that we were talking about into a safe. Unfortunately, she had never told anyone the combination of the safe. So she died with the combination in her head, and I had to deal with this sort of Balzacian French bureaucracy of this town because the safe was in a municipal building. I knew that I had to break open the safe.
You got it open?
Well, eventually I hired a safecracker, and I eventually hired a guy to go into the building with a stethoscope and a drill, and we drilled into it. But the amazing thing was having to navigate the town bureaucracy and sort of get various people on my side to post a police guard outside the door so that nobody would officially see what I was doing and that I was bringing this guy with a leather jacket and a bunch of tools in. And we eventually broke open the safe, and it wasn't just an amazing...
I've heard a lot of research stories, and I've done some research myself. That may be the best one. You hired a safe cracker to blow open the safe where the documents were.
Yes, exactly. with the help of policemen who were let's say...
Sympathetic.
Sympathetic or encouraged by me in various ways.
Oh, yes. Become sympathetic. So you grease the wheels.
Well, you do anything for history, Sam. The amazing thing really was what was inside the safe. When I got that safe open, aside from amazing personal letters, which is what I needed to do the story, these letters between Alex and his wife, Marie-Louise, which is his correspondence that went on throughout his life as a soldier, no matter whether he was in the top of the Alps or in the deserts of Egypt, he always...
He was away from home a lot of the time in writing to her.
Oh, yeah. He was away from home. And they just had a very... It was a real love affair. And but the most important document in the safe was the memoir of Alex's imprisonment in the dungeon in Italy. And it was written in his own hand. And this is the basis of the Count of Monte Cristo.
So it was Napoleon who... had him imprisoned?
Napoleon didn't have him imprisoned. It's a long story, but basically on his way out of Egypt, Alex Dumas leaves Egypt on a leaky boat that is sinking in the Mediterranean, and the only thing that he and the other guys on it can do after throwing all their weapons and horses overboard is to make for the nearest land. And what they do is they hit the land in the very southern tip of Italy, and they are taken prisoner by this mysterious force called the Holy Faith Army, which is another fascinating story. And they're thrown in, but he doesn't know who's taking him prisoner. He's just thrown into a dungeon. They know that they've got this very valuable French general. And this is where Napoleon's cruelty comes in. Clearly, these kidnappers in Italy who throw him in the dungeon, who are really thugs, essentially, they think they're going to get some great ransom from the French. And basically Napoleon is happy to have Alex Dumas out of the way. And so for the next 2 years, he's languishing in prison. He's poisoned. But he's this incredibly tough guy. And he even at one point defends himself from these guys who come in possibly to kill him just using a piece of wood that he finds in his cell. But when he eventually gets out of the dungeon and makes it back to France, he finds that Napoleon has... more than a personal vendetta against him, he's also almost gone on a vendetta against black rights. Napoleon reimposes slavery in the French Empire and creates a rule that throws all black people and men of color out of the French army the same month that he creates the Legion of Honor. So in a funny way, I've written a story that is both totally unknown, yet totally familiar to any of your readers, because everybody knows The Count of Monte Cristo.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Thanks, Sam. It was great.
That's Tom Rees, whose new book, The Black Count, Glory, Revolution, Betrayal, and the Real Count of Monte Cristo, is reviewed in this week's book review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
How you doing, Sam?
So a lot of churn, as they say, on the lists this week.
Yeah, there's a lot of turnover. 13 new books in all, most of them on the fiction side of things, where we have a new number one with Mitch Albom. His new book is called The Timekeeper. It's kind of a fable, a look at Father Time as a young man. At number two is a guy named Michael Ledwidge with a co-writer you might have heard of named James Patterson. His new book is called Zoo. It's about animals attacking American cities, kind of organizing and trying to overthrow humans. At number four, Clive Cussler also has a co-written new book written with Thomas Perry. It's a book called The Tombs. It's the fourth in a series about married treasure hunters.
Question for you.
Yeah.
Writing is a lonely profession. We know that. But do you really have to have somebody there in the room co-writing it with you?
But, you know, Cussler may play a pretty active role. Patterson, you really get the sense that co-writing in his case is putting his name on the cover because he's the brand name. He's what sells the books. It's funny, this book Zoo by Patterson and Ledwidge is just getting terrible reviews on Amazon. And Amazon readers, you know, Patterson has a really big fan base. So he comes out with a new book and people snatch it up. And here it is at number two on the hardcover list. And the early readers are just demolishing this thing. The negative reviews outweigh the positive ones by like 4-1.
All right, what else have we got?
Down at number 8, a serious literary novel, Zadie Smith. Her new novel is called N.W. It looks at a neighborhood in London. It's the same area where her first book, White Teeth, was set. And it follows the lives of four characters from that neighborhood who grew up together and have kind of gone their separate ways. It tracks them over a single weekend.
And what else?
Just below Zadie Smith at number 9, Laurie R. King has a new book called Garment of Shadows. That's the 12th book in her series about Sherlock Holmes's wife, Mary Russell, and it takes them to colonial Morocco.
Onward.
Down at number 13, the fantasy writer S.M. Sterling has a new book in his Change series of post-apocalyptic fantasy epics that's called Lord of Mountains. At number 15, the mystery writer Randy Wayne White has a book called Gone. That's part of his Doc Ford series. And at number 16, Dale Brown has a book called Tiger's Claw. Brown is a former Air Force captain, and he writes these pilot mysteries. This is about a retired Air Force general.
What about nonfiction?
On the nonfiction side, the top book this week, no surprise, it's new to the list. It is No Easy Day by a guy calling himself Mark Owen. His real name we know now is Matt Bissonnette, written with Kevin Moorer. Bissonnette is a former member of the Navy SEALs, and he was there on the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, and this book has just gotten tremendous attention. Mm. Stirred up a lot of controversy, too, in the special forces.
Right, you're not supposed to kill and tell, right?
Yeah, as one of our Times colleagues said a few weeks ago, he said, SEALs don't squeal.
But this one did.
Yeah.
Okay, what else have we got?
Down at number 6, the Olympic gold medalist in cycling, Tyler Hamilton, has a book written with Daniel Coyle called The Secret Race. It's a look at drugs in the world of professional cycling.
Anything else?
At number 9, Paul Tough's book, How Children Succeed. Just below the Paul Tough is another book about fatherhood. This one's a memoir called A Father First by the NBA All-Star guard for the Miami Heat, Dwayne Wade. He's a 2-time championship winner. And then finally on the nonfiction list at number 11, just below the Dwayne Wade book, a pretty interesting book by a guy named Mike Lofgren called The Party Is Over. Lofgren is a very unassuming personality. He spent almost 30 years working as a congressional staffer for various Republicans, ending up his time there working on the budget committee, again, as a staffer. And he's just completely disillusioned about the current state of the Republican Party. And he's he wrote a column and an article about it last year on the website Truth Out that kind of pulled the curtain back and said what a lot of commentators have been saying about the modern Republican Party, but not a lot of Republicans have been saying, which is that it's held hostage by the radical right. It's become a plutocracy, just kowtowing to big money interests all the time.
Has there been much reaction from either politicians he worked for or from Republican officials?
Well, it's interesting. It's gotten a lot of interest. It has gotten respectful reviews. The American Conservative went to a Q&A that he did and gave it a very, very admiring report, saying that he harkened back to Eisenhower Republicanism. He appeals to the libertarian crowd. He says you've got to get big money out of politics. He's got it in for Democrats, too. He says Democrats have become useless. He's seen more that he doesn't like from the Republicans because he's worked closely with them for 30 years. So it's really a book criticizing the Republicans, but he says that the Democrats have just become enablers. They just roll over and let this kind of radical right do what they want.
So this is kind of an inside account, really, of the dysfunctionality of Congress today or in the last many years.
That's exactly right. And he says it's a group of crazies. He really bemoans the anti-intellectualism in it and the religious elements.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.